old dispensation. Probably nothing as incredible as what he might have said, just as the shock flashed his mortal nerves as the angel swooped in. But they will see. Rathenau, according to the histories, was prophet and architect of the cartelized state. From what began as a tiny bureau at the War Office in Berlin, he had coordinated Germany's economy during the World War, controlling supplies, quotas, and prices, cutting across and demolishing the barriers of secrecy and property that separated firm from firm, a corporate Bismarck, before whose power no account book was too privileged, no agreement too clandestine. His father, Emil Rathenau, had founded AEG, the German General Electric Company, but young Walter was more than another industrial heir. He was a philosopher with a vision of the post-war state. He saw the war in progress as a world revolution, out of which would rise neither red communism nor an unhindered right, but a rational structure in which business would be the true, the rightful authority, a structure based, not surprisingly, on the one he'd engineered in Germany for fighting the World War. Thus the official version. Grandiose enough, but Generaldirektor Smaragd and colleagues are not here to be told what even the masses believe. It might almost, if one were paranoid enough, seem to be a collaboration here between both sides of the wall, matter and spirit. What is it they know that the powerless do not? What terrible structure behind the appearances of diversity and enterprise? Gallows humor, a damned parlor game. Smaragd cannot really believe in any of this. Smaragd, the technician and manager, he may only want signs, omens, confirmations of what's already in being. Something to giggle over among the Herrenklub. We even have the Jews' blessing. Whatever comes through the medium tonight, they will warp, they will edit into a blessing. It is contempt of a rare order. Laney finds a couch in a quiet corner of a room full of Chinese ivory and silk hangings, lies on it, one calf dangling, and tries to relax. France now will be home from the rocket field, blinking under the bulb as Frau Silberschlag next door delivers Laney's last message. Messages tonight, born on the lights of Berlin, neon, incandescent, stellar, messages weave into a net of information that no one can escape. The path is clear, a voice moving Saxa's lips and rigid white throat. You are constrained over there to follow it in time, one step after another. But here it's possible to see the whole shape at once. Not for me, I'm not that far along, but many know it as a clear presence. Shape isn't really the right word. Let me be honest with you. I'm finding it harder to put myself in your shoes. Problems you may be having, even those of global implication, seem to many of us here only trivial side trips. You are off on a winding and difficult road, which you conceive to be wide and straight, an autobahn you can travel at your ease. Is it any use for me to tell you that all you believe real is illusion? I don't know whether you'll listen or ignore it. You only want to know about your path, your autobahn. All right. Mauve. That's in the pattern. The invention of mauve. The coming to your level of the color mauve. Are you listening, General Director?
I am listening, Herr Rathenau, replies Smaragd of IG Farben.
Tyrian purple. Alizarin and indigo, other coal-tar dyes are here, but the important one is mauve. William Perkin discovered it in England, but he was trained by Hoffmann, who was trained by Liebig. There is a succession involved. If it is karmic, it's only in a very limited sense. Another Englishman, Herbert Ganister, and the generation of chemists he trained. Then the discovery of honorine. Ask your man Wimp. He is the expert on cyclized benzyl isoquinolines. Look into the clinical effects of the drug. I don't know. It seems that you might look in that direction. It converges with the mauve Perkin-Ganister line. But all I have is the molecule, the sketch, methanarin as the sulfate. Not in Germany, but in the United States. There is a link to the United States, a link to Russia. Why do you think von Maltzahn and I saw the Rapallo Treaty through? It was necessary to move to the East. Wimp can tell you. Wimp, the V-man, was always there. Why do you think we wanted Krupp to sell them agricultural machinery so badly? It was also part of the process. At the time, I didn't understand it as clearly as I do now, but I knew what I had to do. Consider coal and steel. There is a place where they meet. The interface between coal and steel is coal tar. Imagine coal, down in the earth, dead black, no light, the very substance of death. Death ancient, prehistoric, species we will never see again. Growing older, blacker, deeper, in layers of perpetual night. Above ground, the steel rolls out fiery, bright, but to make steel, the coal tars, darker and heavier, must be taken from the original coal. Earth's excrement, purged out for the ennoblement of shining steel, passed over. We thought of this as an industrial process. It was more. We passed over the coal tars. 1,000 different molecules waited in the preterite dung. This is the sign of revealing, of unfolding. This is one meaning of mauve, the first new color on earth, leaping to earth's light from its grave miles and eons below. There is the other meaning, the succession. I can't see that far yet. But this is all the impersonation of life. The real movement is not from death to any rebirth. It is from death to death transfigured. The best you can do is to polymerize a few dead molecules. But polymerizing is not resurrection. I mean your IG, General Director. Our IG, I should have thought, replies Smaragd with more than the usual ice and stiffness. That's for you to work out. If you prefer to call this a liaison, do. I am here for as long as you need me. You don't have to listen. You think you'd rather hear about what you call life, the growing organic cartel, but it's only another illusion. A very clever robot. The more dynamic it seems to you, the more deep and dead in reality it grows. Look at the smokestacks, how they proliferate, fanning the wastes of original waste over greater and greater masses of city. Structurally, they are strongest in compression. The smokestack can survive any explosion, even the shockwave from one of the new cosmic bombs. A bit of a murmur around the table at this. As you all must know, the persistence, then, of structures favoring death, death converted into more death, perfecting its reign just as the buried coal grows denser and overlaid with more strata, epoch on top of epoch, city on top of ruined city. This is the sign of death, the impersonator. These signs are real. They are also symptoms of a process. The process follows the same form, the same structure. To apprehend it, you will follow the signs. All talk of cause and effect is secular history, and secular history is a diversionary tactic, useful to you, gentlemen, but no longer so to us here. If you want the truth, I know, I presume, you must look into the technology of these matters, even into the hearts of certain molecules. It is they, after all, which dictate temperatures, pressures, rate of flow, costs, profits, the shapes of towers. You must ask two questions. First, what is the real nature of synthesis? And then, what is the real nature of control? You think you know, you cling to your beliefs, but sooner or later, you will have to let them go. A silence which prolongs itself. There is some shifting in the seats around the table, but the sets of little fingers stay in touch.
Herr Rathenau, could you tell me one thing?
It is Heinz Rippenstoss, the irrepressible Nazi wag and gadabout. The sitters begin to giggle, and Peter Saxa to return to his room.
Is God really Jewish?
Pum, Easterling, Drummond, Lamplighter, Spectro are stars on the doctor's holiday tree. Shining down on this holiest of nights, each is a cold announcement of dead ends, suns that will refuse to stand but flee south, ever south, leaving us to north without end. But Kevin Spectro is brightest, most distant of all. And the crowds, they swarm in Knightsbridge, and the wireless carols drone, and the underground's a mob scene, but pointsman's all alone. But he's got his Xmas present, fa-la-la, He won't have to settle for any spam tin dog this year, mates. He's got his own miracle and human child, grown to manhood but carrying, someplace on the Slothropian cortex now, a bit of psychology's own childhood. Yes, pure history, inert, insisted, unmoved by jazz, depression, war, a survival, if you will, of a piece of the late Dr. Yumpf himself, past death, past the reckoning of the old central chamber, you know. He has no one to ask, no one to tell. My heart, he feels, my heart floods now with such virility and hope. News from the Riviera is splendid. Experiments here begin to run smoothly for a change, from some dark overlap, a general appropriation or sinking fund someplace. Brigadier Pudding has even improved the funding for ARF. Does he feel Pointsman's power too? Is he buying some insurance? At odd moments of the day, Pointsman, fascinated, discovers himself with an erect penis. He begins making jokes, English Pavlovian jokes, nearly all of which depend on one unhappy accident. The Latin cortex translates into English as bark. Not to mention the well-known and humorous relation between dogs and trees. These are bad enough, and most Pisces folk have the good sense to avoid them, but they are dazzling witticisms compared with jokes out of the mainstream, such as the extraordinary, "What did the Cockney exclaim to the cowboy from San Antonio?" Sometime during the annual Pisces Christmas party, Pointsman is led by Morty Tilkis to a closet full of belladonna, gauze, thistle tubes, and the scent of surgical rubber, where in a flash, she's down on her red knees, unbuttoning his trousers as he, confused, good God, strokes her hair, clumsily shaking much of it loose from its wine-colored ribbon. Here, what's this? An actual slick and crimson, hot, squeak-stockinged slave girl gam. Yes, right among these winter-pale clinical halls, with the distant gramophone playing rumba music, basses, woodblocks, wearied, blown sheets of tropic string cadences audible as everyone dances back there on the uncarpeted floors. And the old Palladian shell, conch of a thousand rooms, gives, resonates, shifting stresses along walls and joists. Bold Maud, this is incredible. Taking the pink Pavlovian cock in as far as it will go, chin to collarbone, vertical as a sword swallower, releasing him each time with some small ladylike choking sound, fumes of expensive scotch rising flower-like, and her hands up grabbing the loose wool seat of his pants, pleating, unpleating. It's happening so fast that Pointsman only sways, blinks a bit drunkenly, you know, wondering if he's dreaming or has found the perfect mixture. Try to remember, amphetamine sulfate, 5 milligrams, Q6H, last night, amobarbital sodium, 0.2 grams at bedtime. This morning, assorted breakfast vitamin capsules, alcohol an ounce, say, per hour over the past. How many cc's is that? And, oh, Jesus, I'm coming. Am I? Yes, well. And Maud, dear Maudie, swallowing, wastes not a drop. Smiling quietly, unplugged at last, she returns the unstiffening hawk to its cold bachelor nest, but kneels still a bit longer in the closet of this moment, the drafty, white-lit moment. Some piece by Ernesto Lecuona. Siboney, perhaps, now reaching them down corridors long as the sea lanes back to the green shoals. Slime stone battlements and palm evenings of Cuba. A Victorian pose, her cheek against his leg, his high-veined hand against her face. But no one saw them, then or ever. And in the winter ahead, here and there, her look will cross his and she'll begin to blush red as her knees. She'll come to his room off the lab once or twice, perhaps, but somehow they're never to have this again. This sudden tropics in the held breath of war and English December, this moment of perfect peace. No one to tell. Maud knows something's up, all right. The finances of Pisces pass through her hands. Nothing escapes her, but he can't tell her, or not everything, not the exact terms of his hope. He's never, even to himself. It lies ahead in the dark, defined inversely by horror. By ways all hopes might yet be defeated, and he find only his death, that dumb, empty joke at the end of this Pavlovian's progress. Now Thomas Gwenhydwit, too, senses change fibrillating in the face and step of his colleague. Fat, prematurely white Santa Claus beard, a listing rumpled showman, performing every instant, trying to speak a double language, both Welsh comic provincial and hard diamond Ghana-begging truth. Hear what you will. His singing voice is incredible. In his spare time, he strolls out past the wire-mesh fighter runways looking for bigger planes, for he loves to practice the bass part to diadem as the flying fortresses take off at full power. And even so, you can hear him, bone vibrating and pure above the bombers all the way to Stoke Pogues, you see. Once a lady even wrote into the Times from Luton Hoo, Bedfordshire, asking who was the man with the lovely deep voice singing Diadem. A Mrs. Snade. Gwen Hidwee likes to drink a lot, grain alcohol mostly, mixed in great strange mad scientist concoctions with beef tea, grenadine, cough syrup, bitter belch-gathering infusions of blue skullcap, valerian root, motherwort, and lady's slipper, whatever's to hand, really. His is the hale alcoholic style, celebrated in national legend and song. He is descended directly from the Welshman in Henry V, who ran around forcing people to eat his leek. None of your sedentary drinkers, though. Pointsman has never seen Gwen Hidwee off of his feet or standing still. He fusses endlessly, pitch and roll, avast you scum down the long rows of sick or dying faces. And even Pointsman has noted rough love in the minor gestures, changes of breathing and voice. They are blacks, Indians, Ashkenazic Jews, speaking dialects you never heard in Harley Street. They have been bombed out, frozen, starved, meanly sheltered, and their faces, even the children's, all possess some ancient intimacy with pain and reverse that amazes Pointsman, who is more polarized upon West End catalogues of genteel signs and symptoms, head-borne anorexias and constipations the Welshman could have little patience with. On Gwen Hidwee's wards, some BMRs run low as 35, 40. The white lines go thickening across the x-ray ghosts of bones. Gray scrapings from underneath tongues bloom beneath his old wrinkle-black microscope into clouds of Vincent-esque invaders. Nasty little fangs atop and looking to ulcerate the vitamin-poor tissue they came from. A quite different domain altogether, you see. I don't know, man, no, I don't. Flinging a fat, slow-motion arm out of his hedgehog-colored cape, back at the hospital as they walk in the falling snow, to Pointsman a clear separation, monks here and cathedral there, soldiers and garrison, but not so to Gwen Hidwee, part of whom remains behind, hostage. The streets are empty. It's Christmas Day. They are tramping uphill to Gwen Hidwee's rooms as the quiet snow curtains fall on and on between themselves and the pierced wall of the institution, marching in stone parallax away into a white gloom. How they persist! The poor, the black, and the Jews! The Welsh! The Welsh once upon a time were Jewish, too? One of the lost tribes of Israel, a black tribe who wandered overland centuries, oh, an incredible journey, until at last they reached Wales, you see. Wales. Stayed on and became the Cymry. What if we're all Jews, you see, all scattered like seeds, still flying outward from the primal fist so long ago? Man, I believe that. Of course you do, Gwen Hidwee. Aren't we then? What about you? I don't know. I don't feel Jewish today. I meant flying outward. He means alone and forever separate. Pointsman knows what he means. So, by surprise, something in him is touched. He feels the Christmas snow now at crevices of his boots, the bitter cold trying to get in. The brown wool flank of Gwen Hidwee moves at the edge of his sight, a pocket of color, a holdout against this whitening day. Flying outward. Flying. Gwen Hidwee, a million ice points falling at a slant across his caped immensity, looking so improbable of extinction that now, from where it's been lying, the same yawing, drunk, chattering fear returns. The curse of the book. And here is someone he wants, truly, with all his mean heart, to see preserved. Though he's been too shy or proud ever to have smiled at Gwen Hidwee without some kind of speech to explain and cancel out the smile. Dogs run barking at their approach. They get the professional eye from Pointsman. Gwen Hidwee is humming Aberystwyth. Out comes the doorkeeper's daughter, Estelle, with a shivering kid or two underfoot and a Christmas bottle of something acrid but very warming inside the breast after about the first minute it's down. Smells of coal smoke, piss, garbage, last night's bubble and squeak fill the hallways. Gwen Hidwee is drinking from the bottle, carrying on a running slap and tickle with Estelle, and getting in a fast game of where'd he go, there he is, with Arch, her youngest, around the broad mouton hip line of his mother who keeps trying to smack him, but he's too fast. Gwen Hidwee breathes upon a gas meter, which is frozen all through, too tight to accept coins. Terrible weather. He surrounds it, curses it. Bending like a screen lover, wings of his cape reaching to enfold, Gwenhydwy, radiating like a sun. Out the windows of the sitting room are a row of bare army-colored poplars, a canal, a snowy train yard, and beyond it a long sawtooth pile of scrap coal, still smoldering from a V-bomb yesterday. Ragged smoke is carried askew, curling, broken, and back to earth by the falling snow. "It's the closest yet," Gwenhydwy at the kettle, the sour smell of a sulfur match in the air. After a moment, still on watch over the gas ring, "Pointsman, do you want to hear something really paranoid?" "You too? Have you consulted a map of London lately? All this great meteoric plague of V-weapons is being dumped out here, you see. Not back on Whitehall, where it's supposed to be, but on me, and I think it is beastly." "What a damned unpatriotic thing to say." "Oh," hawking and spitting into the washbowl, "you don't want to believe it. Why should you? Harley Street lot, my good Jesus Christ." It's an old game with Gwenhydwy, royal fellow, baiting. Some unaccustomed wind or thermocline along the sky is bringing them down the deep choral hum of American bombers. Death's Whitecomb Nava Gani. A switching locomotive creeps silently across the web of tracks below. "They're falling in a Poisson distribution," says Pointsman in a small voice as if it was open to challenge. "No doubt, man, no doubt, an excellent point, but all over the fucking East End, you see." Arch, or someone, has drawn a brown, orange, and blue Gwenhydwy carrying a doctor's bag along a flat horizon line past a green gasworks. The bag's full of gin bottles. Gwenhydwy is smiling. A robin is peeking out from its nest in his beard, and the sky is blue and the sun yellow. "But have you ever thought of why? Here is the city paranoiac, all these long centuries growing over the countryside like an intelligent creature, an actor, a fantastic mimic, pointsman, counterfeiting all the correct forces, the economic, the demographic, oh yes, even the random, you see." "What do you mean, I see, I don't see?" Against the window, backlit by the white afternoon, Pointsman's face is invisible except for a tiny bright crescent glowing off each eyeball. Should he fumble behind him for the window catch? Is the woolly Welshman gone raving mad, then? "You don't see them," steam in tight brocade starting to issue from the steel-blotched swan's mouth. "The blacks and Jews in their darkness. You can't. You don't hear their silence. You became so used to talking and to light." "To barking, anyway. Nothing comes through my hospital but failure, you see." Staring with a fixed, fool alcoholic smile. "What can I cure? I can only send them back outside again. Back to that. It might as well be Europe here, combat, splinting and drugging them all into some minimum condition to get on with the killing." "Here, don't you know there's a war on?" Thus Pointsman receives with his cup a terrible scowl. In truth, he is hoping with nitwit irrelevancies to discourage Gwenhydwy from going on about his city paranoiac. Pointsman would rather talk about the rocket victims admitted today to the hospital down there, but this is exorcism, man. It is the poet singing back the silence, adjuring the white riders, and Gwenhydwy knows, as Pointsman cannot, that it's part of the plan of the day to sit inside this mean room and cry into just such a deafness, that Mr. Pointsman is to play exactly himself, stylized, irritable, uncomprehending. "In some cities the rich live upon the heights, and the poor are found below. In others, the rich occupy the shoreline, while the poor must live inland. Now in London, here is a gradient of wretchedness, increasing as the river widens to the sea. I am only asking why. Is it because of the shipping? Is it in the patterns of land use, especially those relating to the industrial age? Is it a case of ancient tribal taboos surviving down all the English generations? No. The true reason is the threat from the East, you see. And the South. From the mass of Europe, certainly, the people out there were meant to go down first. We're expendable. Those in the West End and north of the river are not. Oh, I don't mean the threat has this or that specific shape. Political, no. If the city paranoiac dreams, it's not accessible to us. Perhaps the city dreamed of another enemy city floating across the sea to invade the estuary. Or of waves of darkness, waves of fire. Perhaps of being swallowed again by the immense, the silent mother continent. It's none of my business, city dreams. But what if the city were a growing neoplasm? Across the centuries, always changing, to meet exactly the changing shape of its very worst secret fears. The raggedy pawns, the disgraced bishop and cowardly knight, all we condemned, we irreversibly lost, are left out here, exposed and waiting. It was known, don't deny it, known, pointsman, that the front in Europe someday must develop like this, move away east, make the rockets necessary, and known how and where the rockets would fall short. Ask your friend Mexico. Look at the densities on his map. East and south of the river, too, where all the bugs live. That's who's getting it thickest, my friend. You're right, Gwen Hedwig. Judicious, sipping his tea. That is very paranoid. It's true. He is out with the festive bottle of Vat 69 now and about to pour them a toast. To the babies, grinning completely mad. Babies, Gwen Hedwig. Ah, I've been keeping my own map, plotting data from the maternity wards. The babies born during this blitz are also following a Poisson distribution, you see. Well, to the oddness of it then, poor little bastards. Later, toward dusk, several enormous water bugs, a very dark reddish-brown, emerge like elves from the wainscoting and go lumbering toward the larder. Pregnant mother bugs, too, with baby translucent outrider bugs flowing along like a convoy escort. At night, in the very late silences between bombers, ack-ack fire, and falling rockets, they can be heard loud as mice munching through Gwen Hidwey's paper sacks, leaving streaks and footprints of shit the color of themselves behind. They don't seem to go in much for soft things, fruits, vegetables, and such. It's more the solid lentils and beans they're into, stuff they can gnaw at, paper and plaster barriers, hard interfaces to be pierced, for they are agents of unification, you see. Christmas bugs. They were deep in the straw of the manger at Bethlehem. They stumbled, climbed, fell glistening red among a golden lattice of straw that must have seemed to extend miles up and downward. An edible tenement world, now and then gnawed through to disrupt some mysterious sheaf of vectors that would send neighbor bugs tumbling ass over antennas down past you as you held on with all legs in that constant tremble of golden stalks. A tranquil world. The temperature and humidity staying nearly steady. The day's cycle damped to only a soft, easy sway of light. Gold to antique gold to shadows. And back again. The crying of the infant reached you, perhaps, as bursts of energy from the invisible distance, nearly unsensed, often ignored. Your savior, you see. Inside the bowl, the two goldfish are making a Pisces sign, head to tail and very still. Penelope sits and peers into their world. There is a little sunken galleon, a China diver in a diving suit, pretty stones and shells she and her sisters have brought back from the sea. Aunt Jessica and Uncle Roger are out in the kitchen, hugging and kissing. Elizabeth is teasing Claire in the hallway. Their mother is in the WC. Sooty the cat sleeps in a chair, a black thundercloud on the way to something else who happens right now to look like a cat. It's boxing day. The evening's very still. The last rocket bomb was an hour ago somewhere south. Claire got a gollywog, Penelope a sweater, Elizabeth a frock that Penelope will grow into. The pantomime Roger took them all to see this afternoon was Hansel and Gretel. Claire immediately took off under the seats where others were moving about by secret paths, a flash of braid or white collar now and then among the tall, attentive uncles in uniform, the coat-draped backs of seats. On stage, Hansel, who was supposed to be a boy but was really a tall girl in tights and smock, cowered inside the cage. The funny old witch foamed at the mouth and climbed the scenery, and pretty Gretel waited by the oven for her chance. Then, the Germans dropped a rocket just down the street from the theater. A few of the little babies started crying. They were scared. Gretel, who was just winding up with her broom to hit the witch right in the bum, stopped, put the broom down, in the gathering silence, stepped to the footlights and sang. Oh, don't let it get you. It will if they let you, but there's something I'll bet you can't see. It's big and it's nasty and it's right over there. It's waiting to get its sticky claws in your hair. Oh, the greengrocer's wishing on a rainbow today, and the dustman is tying his tie, and it all goes along to the same jolly song with a peppermint face in the sky. Now sing along, she smiled, and actually got the audience, even Roger, to sing. With a peppermint face in the sky, aye, and a withered old dream in your heart, you'll get hit with a piece of the pie, aye, with a pantomime ready to start. Oh, the Tommy is sleeping in a snowbank tonight, and the Jerrys are learning to fly. We can fly to the moon, we'll be higher than noon, in our polythene home in the sky. Pretty polythene home in the sky, pretty platinum pins in your hand, or your mother's a big fat machine gun and your father's a dreary young man. Whispered and staccato, oh, the manager's sucking on a corn cob pipe and the bankers are eating their wives. All the world's in a daze while the orchestra plays, so turn your pockets and get your surprise. Turn your pockets and get your surprise. There was nobody there after all, and the lamps up the stairway are dying. It's the season just after the ball. Oh, the palm trees whisper on the beach somewhere, and the lifesaver's heaving a sigh. And those voices you hear, boy and girl of the year, are of children who are learning to die. Penelope's father's chair, in the corner next to the table with the lamp, is empty. It faces her now. You can see the crocheted shawl over the back, many knots of gray, tan, black, and brown, with amazing clarity. In the pattern, or in front of it, something is stirring. At first, no more than refraction, as if there were a source of heat directly in front of the empty chair. No, she whispers out loud. I don't want to. You're not him. I don't know who you are, but you're not my father. Go away. Its arms and legs are silent and rigid. She stares into it. I only want to visit you. You want to possess me? Demonic possessions in this house are not unknown. Is this really Keith, her father? Taken when she was half her present age, and returned now as not the man she knew, but only the shell, with the soft, meaty slug of soul that smiles and loves, that feels its mortality, either rotted away or been picked at by the needle mouths of death by government, a process by which living souls unwillingly become the demons known to the main sequence of Western magic as the Klipoth, shells of the dead. It is also what the present dispensation often does to decent men and women entirely on this side of the grave. In neither process is there any dignity or any mercy. Mothers and fathers are conditioned into deliberately dying in certain preferred ways, giving themselves cancer and heart attacks, getting into motor accidents, going off to fight in the war, leaving their children alone in the forest. They'll always tell you fathers are taken, but fathers only leave. That's what it really is. The fathers are all covering for each other, that's all. Perhaps it's even better to have this presence, rubbing the room dry as glass, slipping in and out of an old chair, than a father who still hasn't died yet, a man you love and have to watch it happening to. In the kitchen, the water in the kettle shakes, creaks toward boiling, and outside the wind blows. Somewhere in another street, a roof slate slides and falls. Roger has taken Jessica's cold hands in to warm against his breast, feeling them icy through his sweater and shirt folded in against him. Yet he stands apart, trembling. He wants to warm all of her, not just comic extremities, once beyond reasonable hope. His heart shakes like the boiling kettle. It has begun to reveal itself. How easily she might go. For the first time he understands why this is the same as mortality and why he will cry when she leaves. He is learning to recognize the times when nothing really holds her but his skinny 20 push-up arms. If she leaves, then it ceases to matter how the rockets fall. But the coincidence of maps, girls, and rocket falls has entered him silently, silent as ice, and quizzling molecules have shifted in lattice-like ways to freeze him. If he could be with her more, if it happened when they were together, in another time, that might have sounded romantic, but in a culture of death, certain situations are just more hep to the jive than others. But they're apart so much. If the rockets don't get her, they're still her lieutenant. Damned Beaver slash Jeremy is the war. He is every assertion the fucking war has ever made. That we are meant for work and government, for austerity. And these shall take priority over love, dreams, the spirit, the senses, and the other second-class trivia that are found among the idle and mindless hours of the day. Damn them, they are wrong, they are insane. Jeremy will take her like the angel itself, in his joyless, weasel-worded come-along, and Roger will be forgotten, an amusing maniac, but with no place in the rationalized power ritual that will be the coming peace. She will take her husband's orders. She will become a domestic bureaucrat, a junior partner, and remember Roger, if at all, as a mistake, thank God, she didn't make. Oh, he feels a raving fit coming on. How the bloody hell can he survive without her? She is the British worm that protects his stooping shoulders and the wintering sparrow he holds inside his hands. She is his deepest innocence in spaces of bough and hay before wishes were given a separate name to warn that they might not come true, and his lithe Parisian daughter of joy, beneath the eternal mirror, forswearing perfumes, cape skin to the armpits, all that is too easy for his impoverishment and more worthy love. You go from dream to dream inside me. You have passage to my last shabby corner, and there, among the debris, you've found life. I'm no longer sure which of all the words, images, dreams, or ghosts are yours and which are mine. It's past sorting out. We're both being someone new now, someone incredible. His act of faith. In the street, the children are singing, Hark the herald angels sing, Mrs. Simpson's pinched our king. Up on the mantelpiece, Sooty's son, Kim, an alarmingly fat cross-eyed Siamese, lurks waiting to do the only thing he enjoys these days. Beyond eating, sleeping, or fucking, his chief obsession is to jump or topple on his mother and lie there laughing while she runs screaming around the room. Jessica's sister, Nancy, comes out of the loo to break up what's becoming a full-scale row between Elizabeth and Claire. Jessica steps away from Roger to blow her nose. The sound is as familiar to him as a bird's song. Ip, 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 ngung, as the handkerchief comes away. Oh, super duper, she says. Think I'm catching a cold. You're catching the war. It's infecting you, and I don't know how to keep it away. Oh, Jess. Jessica. Don't leave me. 2. Un perm au casino. Hermann Göring. You will have the tallest, darkest leading man in Hollywood. Marion C. Cooper, Tufe Ray. This morning's streets are already clattering near and far with wood-soled civilian feet. Up in the wind is a scavenging of gulls, sliding, easy, side to side, wings hung out still, now and then a small shrug, only to gather lift for this weaving, unweaving, white and slow pharaoh shuffle off invisible thumbs. Yesterday's first glance, coming along the esplanade in the afternoon, was somber. The sea in shades of gray under gray clouds, the casino, Hermann Göring, flat white and the palms in black sawtooth, hardly moving. But this morning the trees in the sun now are back to green. Leftward, far away, the ancient aqueduct loops crumbling dry yellow out along the cap, the houses and villas there baked to warm rusts, gentle corrosions all through earth's colors, pale raw to deeply burnished. The sun, not very high yet, will catch a bird by the ends of his wings, turning the feathers brightly there to curls of shaved ice. Slothrop rattles his teeth at the crowd of birds aloft, shivering down on his own miniature balcony, electric fire deep in the room barely touching the backs of his legs. They have filed him high on the white sea facade in a room to himself. Tantivy Muckermaffick and his friend Teddy Bloat are sharing one down the hall. He takes back his hands into ribbed cuffs of a sweatshirt, crosses his arms, watches the amazing foreign morning, the ghosts of his breathing into it, feeling first sun warmth, wanting a first cigarette, and perversely he waits for a sudden noise to begin his day, a first rocket. Aware of all the time he's in the wake of a great war gone north, and that the only explosions around here will have to be champagne corks, motors of sleek Hispano-Suizas, the odd amorous slap, hopefully. No London, no Blitz. Can he get used to it? Sure. And by then, it'll be just time to head back. Well, he's awake. Bloat in uniform, sidling into the room, gnawing on a smoldering pipe. Tantivy behind in a pinstriped lounge suit. Up at the crack, reconnoitering the beach for the unattached mamselle or two, no doubt. Couldn't sleep, Fothrop yawning back down into the room, birds in the sunlight kiting behind him.
Nor we, from Tantivy. It must take years to adjust.
God, Bloat really pushing the forced enthusiasm this morning, pointing theatrically at the enormous bed, collapsing onto it, bouncing vigorously.
They must have had advance word about you, Slothrop. Luxury. They gave us some disused closet, you know.
Hey, what are you telling him? Slothrop forages around for cigarettes. I'm some kind of a Van Johnson or something?
Only that in a matter of...
Tantivy from the balcony, tossing his green pack of cravens. Girls, you know.
Englishmen being rather reserved,
Bloat explains, bouncing for emphasis.
Oh, raving maniacs.
Slothrop mumbles, heading for his private lavatory. Been invaded by a gang of those Section 8s, all right.
Stands pleased, pissing no hands, lighting up, but wondering a little about that Bloat.
Supposed to be old-time pals with Tantivy. He snaps the match into the toilet, a quick hiss. Yet something about the way he talks to Slothrop. Patronizing? Maybe nervous.
You're expecting me to fix you guys up?
He yells over the crash of the toilet flushing.
I thought the minute you guys get across that channel, set foot on that France, you all turn into Valentinos.
End of side 6. To continue, change side selector switch and turn the cassette over. Side 7. Gravity's Rainbow by Thomas Pynchon. Continuing on page 212.
I hear there was some pre-war tradition, Tantivy hanging plaintive now in the doorway, but Bloat and I are members of the new generation. We have to depend on Yank expertise.
Whereupon Bloat leaps from the bed and seeks to enlighten Slothrop with a song. The Englishman's very shy, Foxtrot. Bloat.
The Englishman's very shy. He's none of your Casanova. At bowling the ladies over, Americans lead the pack.
Tantivy.
You see, your Englishman tends to lack that recklessness transatlantic that women find so romantic, though frankly I can't see why.
Bloat.
The polygamous Yank with his girls galore gives your British rake or carouser fits.
Tantivy.
Though he's secretly held in reverent awe at a sort of erotic Clausewitz.
Together, if only one could ally American bedroom know-how with British good looks, then oh how those lovelies would swoon and sigh, though you and I know the Englishman's very shy.
Well, you've sure come to the right place,
nods Slothrop, convinced.
Only don't expect me to put it in for you.
Just the initial approach, Bloat says.
Moi!
Tantivy has meanwhile been screaming down from the balcony.
Moi, Tantivy, you know Tantivy.
Tantivy, replies a dim girl chorus from outside and below.
J'ai deux amis, aussi, by an odd coincidence, par une bizarre coincidence, or something, oui?
Slothrop, at this point shaving, wanders out with the foamy badger brush in his fist to see what's happening, and collides with Bloat, who's dashing to peer down over his compatriot's left epaulette at three pretty girls' faces, upturned, straw-haloed each by a giant sun hat, smiles all dazzling, eyes mysterious as the sea behind them.
I say, ooh, inquires Bloat. Ooh, you know, déjeuner?
Glad I could help you out, Slothrop mutters, lathering Tantivy between the shoulder blades.
But come with us, the girls are calling above the waves, two of them holding up an enormous wicker basket out of which lean sleek green wine bottles and rough-crusted loaves still from under their white cloth steaming in little wisps feathering off of chestnut glazes and paler split streaks. Come, sur la plage.
I'll just, Bloat half out the door, keep them company until you...
Sur la plage.
Tantivy a bit dreamy, blinking in the sun, smiling down at their good morning's wishes come true.
Oh, it sounds like a painting, something by an impressionist, a fauve, full of light.
Slothrop goes, flicking witch hazel off his hands. The smell in the room brings back a moment of Berkshire Saturdays, bottles of plum and amber tonics, fly-studded paper twists swayed by the overhead fan, twinges of pain from blunt scissors. Struggling out of his sweatshirt, lit cigarette in his mouth, smoke coming out the neck like a volcano.
Hey, could I bum one of your... You've already got the pack, cries Tantivy. God almighty, what is that supposed to be? What's what?
Sothrop's face nothing but innocent as he slips into and begins to button the object in question.
You're joking, of course. The young ladies are waiting, Sothrop. Do put on something civilized, there's a good chap.
All set, Sothrop on the way past the mirror, combing his hair into the usual sporty Bing Crosby pompadour.
You can't expect us to be seen with... My brother Hogan sent it to me,
Sothrop lets him know.
For my birthday, all the way from the Pacific. See on the back? Under the fellows in that outrigger canoe there, to the left of those hibiscus blossoms, it says Souvenir of Honolulu? This is the authentic item, Mucker Maffick, not some cheap imitation.
Dear God,
moans Tantivy, trailing him forlornly out of the room, shading his eyes from the shirt which glows slightly in the dimness of the corridor.
At least tuck it in and cover it with something. Here, I'll even lend you this Norfolk jacket.
Sacrifice indeed. The coat is from a Savile Row establishment whose fitting rooms are actually decorated with portraits of all the venerable sheep, some nobly posed up on crags, others in pensive soft close-ups, from whom the original fog-silvered wool was sheared.
Must be woven out of that barbed wire, is Slothrop's opinion. What girl'd want to get near anything like that? Ah, but would any woman in her right mind want to be within 10 miles of that ghastly shirt, eh?
Wait. From some place, Sothrop now produces a gaudy yellow, green, and orange display handkerchief, and over Tantivy's groans of horror, arranges it in his friend's jacket pocket so as to stick out in 3 points.
There, beaming. That's what you call real sharp.
They emerge into sunlight. Gulls begin to wail. The garment on Sothrop blazes into a refulgent light of its own. Tantivy squeezes his eyes shut. When he opens them, the girls are all attached to Sothrop, stroking the shirt, nibbling at its collar points, cooing in French.
Of course, Tantivy picks up the basket. Right.
The girls are dancers. The manager of the casino, Hermann Göring, one Cesar Flabotomo, brought in a whole chorus line soon as the liberators arrived, though he hasn't yet found time to change the place's occupation name. Nobody seems to mind it up there, a pleasant mosaic of tiny and perfect seashells. Thousands of them set in plaster, purple, pink, and brown, replacing a huge section of roof. The old tiles still lie in a heap beside the casino. Put up 2 years ago as recreational therapy by a Messerschmitt squadron on furlough, in German typeface, expansive enough to be seen from the air, which is what they had in mind. The sun now is still too low to touch the words into any more than some bare separation from their ground, so that they hang suppressed, no relation any more to the men, the pain in their hands, the blisters that grew black under the sun with infection and blood, only receding as the party now walk down past sheet and pillowcases of the hotel, spread to dry on the slope of the beach, fine wrinkles edged in blue that will flow away as the sun climbs. 6 pairs of feet, stirring debris never combed for, an old gambling chip half bleached by the sun, translucent bones of gulls, a drab singlet, Wehrmacht issue, torn and blotted with bearing grease. They move along the beach. Slothrop's amazing shirt, Tantivy's handkerchief, girls' frocks, green bottles all dancing, everyone talking at once, boy and girl lingua franca, the girls confiding quite a lot to each other with side glances for their escorts. This ought to be good for a bit of the early paranoia here, a sort of pick-me-up to help face what's sure to come later in the day. But it isn't. Much too good a morning for that. Little waves are rolling in, breaking pie-crust-wise along a curve of dark shingle. Farther off, foaming among the black rocks that poke up along the cap. Out at sea wink twin slivers of a boat's sails, being sucked along in the sun and distance over toward Antibes, the craft tacking gradual, cockle frail among low swells, whose touch and rowdy hiss along the chines Sothrop can feel this morning, reminded of pre-war comets and Hamptons sighted from the beach at Cape Cod. Among land odors, drying seaweed, summer-old cooking oil, the feel of sand on sunburn, the sharp-pointed dune grass under bare feet. Closer to shore, a pedalo full of soldiers and girls moves along. They dangle, splash, sprawl in green and white striped lounge chairs back aft. At the edge of the water, small kids are chasing, screaming, laughing in that hoarse, helplessly tickled little kid way. Up on the esplanade, an old couple sit on a bench, blue and white in a cream-colored parasol,
a morning habit, an anchor for the day. They go as far as the first rocks, finding there an inlet partly secluded from the rest of the beach and from the looming casino. Breakfast is wine, bread, smiling, sun diffracting through the fine gratings of long dancers' hair, swung, flipped, never still, a dazzle of violet, sorrel, saffron, emerald. For a moment you can let the world go, solid forms gone a-fracturing, warm inside of bread waiting at your fingertips. Flowery wine in long, easy passage streaming downward around the root of your tongue. Bloat cuts in.
I say, Slothrop, is she a friend of yours, too?
What's happening? She what? Here sits Bloat, smug, gesturing over at the rocks and a tide pool nearby.
You're getting the eye, old man.
Well, she must have come out of the sea. At this distance, some 20 meters, he is only a dim figure in a black bombazine frock that reaches to her knees, her bare legs long and straight, a short hood of bright blonde hair keeping her face in shadow, coming up in guiches to touch her cheeks. She's looking at Slothrop all right. He smiles, sort of waves. She only continues to stand, the breeze pushing at her sleeves. He turns back to draw the cork from a wine bottle, and its pop arrives as a grace note for a scream from one of the dancers. Tantivy's already halfway to his feet, Bloat gaping out in the girl's direction, the danseuse's snapshot and defense reflexes, hair flying, frocks twisted, thighs flashing.
Holy shit, it's moving. An octopus? Yes, it is the biggest fucking octopus Slothrop has ever seen outside of the movies, Jackson, and it has just risen up out of the water and squirmed halfway onto one of the black rocks. Now cocking a malignant eye at the girl, it reaches out, wraps one long, sucker-studded tentacle around her neck as everyone watches, another around her waist, and begins to drag her, struggling, back under the sea. Slothrop's up, bottle in hand, running down past Tantivy, who's doing a hesitant dance step, hands patting lounge suit pockets for weapons that aren't there. More and more of the octopus revealed the closer he comes, and wow, it's a big one, holy cow, skids to a halt alongside, 1 foot in a tide pool, and commences belting the octopus in the head with the wine bottle. Hermit crabs slide in death struggle around his foot. The girl, already half in the water, is trying to cry out, but the tentacle, flowing and chilly, barely allows her windway enough to breathe. She reaches out a hand, a soft-knuckled child's hand with a man's steel ID bracelet on the wrist, and clutches at Slothrop's Hawaiian shirt, begins tightening her own grip there, and who was to know that among her last things would be vulgar-faced hula girls, ukuleles, and surf riders, all in comic book colors. Oh, God, God, please, the bottle thudding again and again wetly into octopus flesh. No fucking use. The octopus gazes at Slothrop triumphant, while he, in the presence of certain death, can't quit staring at her hand. Cloth furrowing in tangents to her terror, a shirt button straining at a single last thread. He sees the name on the bracelet, scratched silver letters, each one clear but making no sense to him before the slimy gray stranglehold that goes tightening, liquid, stronger than he and she together, framing the poor hand its cruel tetanus is separating from earth.
Slothrop!
Hears Bloat 10 feet away, offering him a large crab. What the fuck? Maybe if he broke the bottle on the rock, stabbed the bastard between the eyes.
It's hungry. It'll go for the crab. Don't kill it, Slothrop. Here, for God's sake.
And here it comes, spinning through the air, legs cocked centrifugally outward. Dithering, Slothrop drops the bottle just before the crab smacks against his other palm. Neat catch. Immediately, through her fingers and his shirt, he can feel the reflex to food.
Okay.
Shaking, Slothrop waves the crab at the octopus.
Chow time, fella.
Another tentacle moves in. Its corrugated ooze touches his wrist. Slothrop tosses the crab a few feet along the beach, and what do you know? That octopus goes for it, all right. Dragging along the girl and Slothrop, staggering for a bit, then letting her go. Slothrop quickly snatches up the crab again, dangling it so the octopus can see, and begins to dance the creature away down the beach, drool streaming from its beak, eyes held by the crab. In their brief time together, Slothrop forms the impression that this octopus is not in good mental health, though where's his basis for comparing? But there is a mad exuberance, as with inanimate objects which fall off of tables when we are sensitive to noise and our own clumsiness and don't want them to fall, a sort of wham. Ha ha, you hear that? Here it is again. Wham!
in the cephalopod's every movement, which Slothrop is glad to get away from as he finally scales the crab like a discus, with all his strength out to sea, and the octopus, with an eager splash and gurgle, strikes out in pursuit and is presently gone. The frail girl lies on the beach, taking in great breaths of air, surrounded now by the others. One of the dancers is holding her in her arms and speaking R's and nasals, still French, in a language Slothrop, moseying back into earshot, can't quite place. Tant Ivy smiles and flips a small salute. "Good show," cheers Teddy Bloat. "I wouldn't have wanted to try that myself."
"Why not? You had that crab."
"Say, where'd you get that crab?"
"Found it," replies Bloat with a straight face.
Slothrop stares at this bird but can't get eye contact. What the fuck's going on?
"I better have some of that wine," Slothrop reckons. He drinks out of the bottle. Air goes splashing upward in lopsided spheres inside the green glass. The girl watches him. He stops for breath and smiles.
"Thank you, Lieutenant." Not a tremor in the voice, and the accent is Teutonic. He can see her face now. Soft nose of a doe. Eyes behind blonde lashes full of acid green. One of those thin-lipped European mouths.
"I had almost stopped breathing."
"You're not German."
Shaking her head, no, emphatically.
"Dutch."
"And have you been here?"
Her eyes go elsewhere. She reaches, takes the bottle from his hand. She is looking out to sea after the octopus.
"They are very optical, aren't they? I hadn't known. It saw me. Me. I don't look like a crab."
"I guess not. You're a swell-looking lady."
In the background, delighted Bloat nudges Tant Ivy. That recklessness transatlantic. Slothrop takes her wrist, finds no problem now reading that ID bracelet says Katja Borgesius. He can feel her pulse booming. Does she know him from someplace? Strange. A mixture of recognition and sudden shrewdness in her face. So it is here, grouped on the beach with strangers, that voices begin to take on a touch of metal, each word a hard-edged clap, and the light, though as bright as before, is less able to illuminate. It's a Puritan reflex of seeking other orders behind the visible, also known as paranoia, filtering in. Pale lines of force whir in the sea air, pacts sworn to in rooms since shelled back to their planned views, not quite by accident of war, suggest themselves. Oh, that was no found crab, Ace. No random octopus or girl. Structure and detail come later, but the conniving around him now he feels instantly in his heart. They all stay a bit longer on the beach, finishing breakfast. But the simple day, birds and sunlight, girls and wine, has sneaked away from Slothrop. Tant Ivy is getting drunk, more relaxed and funnier as the bottle's empty. He staked out not only the girl he first had his eye on, but also the one Slothrop would be no doubt sweet-talking right now if that octopus hadn't shown up. He is a messenger from Slothrop's innocent pre-octopus past. Bloat, on the other hand, sits perfectly sober, mustache unruffled, regulation uniform, watching Slothrop closely. His companion, Ghislaine, tiny and slender, pin-up girl legs, long hair brushed behind her ears, falling all the way down her back, shifts her round bottom in the sand, writing marginal commentaries around the text of Bloat. Slothrop, who believes that women, like Martians, have antennas men do not, keeps an eye on her. She looks over only once, and her eyes grow wide and cryptic. He'd swear she knows something. On the way back to the casino, toting their empties and the basket full of the debris of the morning, he manages a word with her. "Some picnic, n'est-ce pas?" Dimples appear next to her mouth. "Did you know all the time about the octopus?" "I thought so, because it was so like a dance, all of you."
"No, honestly, I didn't. You mean you thought it was just a practical joke or something?"
"Little Tyrone," she whispers, suddenly taking his arm with a big phony smile for the others.
"Little? He's twice her size. Please be very careful."
That's all. He has Katya by the other hand, two imps contrary either side. The beach is empty now except for 50 gray gulls sitting watching the water. White heaps of cumulus pose out at sea, hard-surfaced, cherub-blown, palm leaves stir all down the esplanade. Ghislaine drops away, back down the beach to pick up Prim Bloat.
Katya squeezes Slothrop's arm and tells him just what he wants to hear about now. Perhaps, after all, we were meant to meet. From out at sea, the casino at this hour is a blazing bijou at the horizon. Its foil of palms already shadows in the dwindling light. Deepening go the yellow-brown of these small serrated mountains, sea-colored the soft inside of a black olive, white villas,